This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Appreciate you all taking time this afternoon to join us for another edition of Midrats. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you should find the chat room there. That's a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, that's a good place to put them there. Also, if there is a question you would like for us to direct our guest, that it doesn't appear that we're headed in that direction, go ahead and type it right in there. We'll be more than happy to steal your good ideas. And if you find that you have to leave the show to go do something else and you want to catch up on what you missed, or if we keep talking after the end of the hour, for those that are with us live, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just do a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes. But hey, let's go ahead and get on with today's show. We're going back to a semi-regular topic here on Midrats, something that has never really gone away. It's been almost 20 years since the world has looked at a challenge, forgotten about it, and it started to tap us on the shoulder once again. They're related in some important ways, but as the world has gotten more complicated, there's not as binary as it was back when at least people my generation were kids. And that is Russia and the prospect of nuclear war, either with us or with other parties. It did not go away with the Cold War, and it is back with us with bells on today. Especially in the last 15 years, when rightfully so, a lot of our focus has been on the expansion of radical Islam from the ashes of the Soviet Union, helped along with a charismatic leader and a boom, until recently, of course, from their resource extraction economy. Russia has begun to reassert itself on the Eurasian landmass like it has for over half a millennium. And it's something, though, here in the 21st century, we need to get a better handle of. Also, the nuclear genie has been out of the mathematical and physics model for a very long time. And as the rest of the world gains in their technological expertise, you can't classify math and physics. There inevitably will be additional nuclear challenges beyond Russia that we'll need to intellectualize and look at how we're going to deal with as a nation in conjunction with our allies. And we've got a guest on for the full hour today that I think is just one of the ideal people to talk about these two important topics. And that will be Dr. Tom Nichols. Tom is a professor at the Naval War College and at the Harvard Extension School. He's also a senior associate of the Carnegie Council on Ethics and International Affairs in New York City and a fellow of the International History Institute at Boston University. Previously, he was a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in D.C. But before coming to the War College, he taught international relations and Russian affairs for many years at the Dartmouth College and Georgetown University. In D.C., he was on the personal staff for defense and security affairs in the United States Senate for the late Senator John Hines of Pennsylvania. Keeping with the East Coast theme, he received his PhD from Georgetown and an MA from Columbia University and the certificate of the Harriman Institute at Columbia. And even though we're not going to force him to answer all of our questions in the form of a question, he is a five-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. Back in the 90s, you would have saw him in the Tournament of Champions. And as you wander around the Jeopardy Hall of Fame, you can look at his mug there on the wall. He also was brought back for an encore tour in 2005 for the Ultimate Tournament of Champions. Tom, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks, Sal. Thanks for having me.
Hey, appreciate it. And just kind of as a scene setter to get things going, I wanted to roll by one of my little pet theories for you here. To get people starting to think about the challenge of Russia halfway through 2015? Because I've always believed that to start thinking right, you need to stop thinking wrong. And especially with Russia, and I've been guilty of this myself on occasion, is I have some habits that I developed on how I would think about the Soviet Union, her motivations, and her concerns. Of course, the Soviet Union's no longer with us, and even though she has her seat on the Security Council, Russia is a distinct creature in many ways from the Soviet Union. For people that are trying to get their mind around Russia today, what are those ideas and concepts and understandings they had of the Soviet Union that are transferable and are still useful when trying to get your mind around Russia today? But what are some of those things that people need to leave behind, and perhaps new things they need to hoist on board as they try to understand the challenge that Russia presents?
Well, that's a great question, because we were so used to thinking about Russia and the Soviet Union in the same way for a good 50 years. And even if the people were too young to remember the Soviet Union or remember it in any detail, it's hard to let go of some of those things. A couple of things I would think about leaving behind. One is the whole notion of ideology and communism in particular. You know, the old Soviet Union was run by first and second generation revolutionaries. The guys who were finally around when the whole thing came crashing to the ground weren't the original revolutionaries, but they were kind of the grandchildren of the revolution. So you had people like Lenin and Stalin running the Soviet Union, and then people who knew Stalin in the next generation, people like Khrushchev. And then you got a little further out, and it was people who had been groomed by people like Andropov and Brezhnev who came to power. And they were all part of this Communist Party lineage. They were all soaked in that ideology, and that they were just a product of that system. Now, Putin is also a product of that system, but he really, his regime and the way he runs the Soviet Union, it's not ideologically deep. What he took away from it was the great power nature of the Soviet Union. So he really is, and I've argued this in writing many times, Putin's not a nationalist and he's not a communist. What he really is he's a product, he's a leftover of the old Soviet system, and he has a kind of weird Soviet nostalgia. So when you think about Putin and Russia, the way to think about him is in terms of Sovietism rather than communism. Because the Putin regime really doesn't have an ideology. They're not committed to anything other than Russia being big and powerful and controlling the Eurasian space. I would say, think about the old Soviet Union. You think of a bunch of guys in bad suits, these kind of gray bureaucratic men who collectively ran the Soviet Union. The way to think about Putin now is to think about Putin as kind of Tony Soprano. He's a gangster at the head of a bunch of gangsters, and he's the top guy, but he's always got to be looking over his shoulder. He's always got to worry about what's going on below him. In a sense, the guys before him, even though they were competitive and cutthroat and, you know, certainly wasn't exactly the collegial working environment, but this is a different kind of thing. If they were bound by a revolutionary, at least what was left over from a revolutionary ethos by the 1960s or 70s. And I think one of the reasons the Soviet Union fell is that by the 1980s, none of them could really remember anymore. They couldn't really figure out what the whole point of being a Soviet Union was. Putin's left all that behind. What's really taken away from it is things like the Soviet national anthem and old Soviet borders and the notion of the Kremlin as a power equal to the United States. But in the end, it's a bunch of gangsters. It's a gangster regime. So, you know, short version is we've gone from Stalin and Brezhnev to Tony Soprano and Fat Pauly and, you know, kind of the gang model of a regime.
When you use this, I'm going to use the word great powerism because I think you're absolutely right that it's not anything more than a longing for Russia to be a great power. When you look at his movements into Ukraine and in the Crimea, and some of the deals he's cut with people in Syria, and the sort of approach he's taken to Iran, is that more gangsterism, reaching out to other thugocracies or other gangs and trying to reclaim especially in Ukraine, reclaim those lost borders? Is that what you're looking at?
In part, yeah, because I first of all, I do think, and you know, I'm going to be a kind of an armchair psychologist for a minute here and say it's also the psychology of a particular guy who in late middle age is trying to recreate the world he knew in 1970. It's hard to understate the trauma of people who were brought up in the Soviet regime and then saw it all, especially a guy like Putin, whose life was bound to the Soviet regime. They took him, he was nobody, he was a nothing, and they made him into somebody important. He was a KGB lieutenant colonel. You know, he wasn't the best. He didn't get the most glamorous posting. He wasn't a senior officer, but he, in the Soviet system, a guy who's in the KGB is somebody. And then that all ends. And so he was attached to that old system in a way that that other people, I think, were less attached. Their attachment was not as strong as his. This is a guy who we've seen weep at hearing the Soviet national anthem, which he brought back as the Russian national anthem. I mean, he restored that anthem because, again, it just touches something very deep in him. Now, that doesn't mean he wants to go back to official communism and get rid of all the billions of dollars in his secret bank accounts or not have Moscow wall-to-wall with great restaurants and, you know, all kinds of all the trappings of Western decadence that the old Soviet leaders pretty much stamped out for everybody but themselves. But that hangover of the old Soviet days when the Soviet Union, you know, nothing was resolved anywhere in the world without consulting the Soviet Union. And he misses that. And that's what he's trying to bring back. And let's face it, there's a ton of money involved in all this for him. Every one of those deals involves some kind of an angle. This regime hardly does anything that somebody's pockets aren't being lined in Moscow. So it's a combination of great powerism, I think. You know, you put it really well with that, a kind of Soviet spin on that great powerism, and also just pure outright gangsterism by an old, by a man who's approaching old age and just can't make sense of the world that doesn't exist because it, you know, went away 20 years ago.
Let's pull the thread a bit on that gangsterism and gangster state, because I think it's a great reference point to use as you try to get around how that nation is being run now. And of course, talk to people in the FBI or people who've written the books about it. One thing about gangster organizations is they have unless there's a definite family member involved who's clearly competent, there's a succession issue when the head of the family passes. You know what, and they're bloody and they're not pretty. And you know what will Russia have to look at post Putin, whenever that is, or whatever causes it? And has he left any type of governmental legacy behind that will help Russia in transition, or is this one of those known unknowns that the remaining Russian hands we have in our foreign policy and national security arena need to start wargaming to a certain extent?
I think he doesn't know how to let go of power. I think the change that occurred in Putin happened when he decided to go for a third term. And this is where I have to serve myself up this big, keeping, steaming bucket of crow that I have to eat every time I talk about Putin. Because I was one of the group of people around 2001, 2002, where I said, you know, there's no evidence right now that Putin's going to be nearly as bad as we're concerned about. You know, he was doing things, he was engaging in reforms that actually needed to be done in the Soviet Union, things like judicial reform and reforming Moscow's relationship to regions. He was trying to restore a little bit of national pride, which was, you know, given the way the Soviet Union crashed and burned, it's understandable. I just wasn't that worried about Putin. In fact, I used to say, I would be talking to colleagues in places like Poland, and I'd say, what is everyone so worried about? I mean, it's not like Putin's going to march across Ukraine. You know, it's not like the Russians are going to start marching across Ukraine on their way to Europe. And of course, I've had to eat every one of those not very tasty words over the past 7 or 8 years. And one question that arises when the Russia heads like me start talking about this is, were we that wrong, or did Putin change? And I think It's a little bit of both. I suspect that people like me were a little too optimistic, but I also think that Putin, once he really got his hands on power and he started squirreling away a ton of money, suddenly realized that he just, first of all, I think he didn't want to retire and he wasn't comfortable with not being in charge. There was that whole experiment where he steps down, becomes the prime minister. Dmitry Medvedev steps up, becomes the president. And I think we were all saying, well, okay, so now Putin's going to take, he's going to do this thing. Medvedev's going to run for reelection. Putin's going to take his billions and go off to a dacha and be kind of a shadowy kingmaker as he heads into his old age. And I think Putin somewhere in there decided that wasn't good enough and it wasn't safe enough. That the only way he was going to live out, you know, the rest of his days was to get back into power and run things forever. And, you know, going back to the Sopranos metaphor, if you guys had watched the Sopranos, and of course it went off the air some years ago, so if anybody's listening who doesn't want a spoiler, too bad. But Tony, at one point in the series, says, look, guys like me either get killed or we die in jail. And I think Putin reached that same conclusion, that if I, no matter how much money I take, when I retire, it's not going to be safe enough. So maybe I have to go back into power and stay there forever. And I think that's when he really decided that he couldn't tolerate any dissent. Things started going bad with the West, and he kind of gave into his full head of steam about reliving his Soviet youth. Because the other thing that we didn't talk about that's also spent in Russia, even though it's not a communist or revolutionary worldview, is a deeply ingrained anti-Americanism. Because America, just by existing, triggers a huge inferiority complex in these guys. And in a lot of Russia, anti-Americanism is a really easy sell in Russia. Because Russians have a really deep inferiority complex about the West and about Russia and about the United States in particular. So Putin just decided, I think, to come back to the point, he decided he couldn't retire, he couldn't let go of power. He couldn't step down. There wasn't enough money in the world. And you asked about, Sal, I think you asked about what's the legacy he leaves behind. The legacy that there are bodies buried all over now, especially after the murder of Nemtsov, literally bodies buried all over the place. And the next guy who comes in is going to have a hornet's nest on his hand because there's just little time bombs all over the Kremlin that Putin's going to leave in his wake. Now, Putin lives to be, you know, 95 years old, and people have time to establish a succession. Because remember, the Soviet Union had problems with succession, too. You know, these were old guys, but they would see the end coming and people would start moving into place. Putin lives to be 95. They'll have time to figure it out. If Putin drops dead tomorrow, there's going to be a major international crisis in the offing because nobody knows what to do next because the whole system depends on him, and that's a terrible thing.
When you, I love this inferiority complex because it seems to me that a lot of the moves that Putin's made, Ukraine, the support for Syria, the joint exercises he's got scheduled with China. Kind of a reapproachment with Iran, are all designed to tweak the Americans. And, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I guess. Am I on the right track with that or totally off base?
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. Remember, Russia has no alliances and it has no real friends. And so, you know, pretty much the only way it can express itself in international relations is to go find people that don't like the same people they don't like. Even during the Cold War, when they had the Warsaw Pact, Soviet experts used to joke that the Soviet Union was the only country in the world surrounded by hostile communist powers. Their own alliance system was an involuntary empire around them, full of countries of people who hated them. And so now Russia, you know, Russia talks about, well, we have friends here, we have friends there. Russia doesn't have any friends. Russia has people it gets along with on an expedient basis, based on money and weapons and other, you know, pretty unsavory things. And that always includes kind of a list of the world's great scumbags, like people like Assad and the Castros and others. I think you're absolutely on the market. A lot of Russian foreign policy is organized around the principle that a day in which you annoy the United States is a day well spent. And that's, you know, we've unfortunately played along with that really well because we're kind of AWOL, we're out of this game for now. I mean, we pretty much handed the Middle East over to them as part of this insanely, you know, accommodating Syria deal over 2 years ago, and they're more than happy to take it because they crave the status of being co-equal to the United States. They really feel that keenly, that when the Cold War ended, their superpower status just evaporated, and they're really reveling in the idea that they could be getting that back and being thought of as a power co-equal to the United States. And we unfortunately have been their enablers in this through, I think, some very clumsy foreign policy.
You know, maybe part of that had to do with how we opened the show is our old Russian hands or old Soviet hands, and we just exacerbated the little insecure kid down the street. And when you look at one of the organizations, you know, talk about them trying to get friends and allies, during the peak of the resource boom a couple of years ago, everybody wanted to talk about the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and these new developing countries and how they're going to find an alternative to the dollar and challenge the U.S. Of course, Brazil has once again is going through that. We will disappoint every generation's futurists. Russia, we're talking about India. The ongoing challenge, I guess the biggest news out of India is they're going to actually try to build their own aircraft carrier because they're tired of sinking their own submarines. And of course, China, they've devalued their currency this week. And I think we're going to see a few more secondary impacts of that over the course of the next year. So when you look at BRIC, their economic response to challenge the U.S., have they stepped up to the plate and whiffed here? And if you have some visibility on it, how much do you think in the global realm of the diplomatic side of the equation, the diplomats understand the economic side of the equation with the crashing of the oil prices and how this is going to impact Russia, which really is more than most nations so dependent on resource extraction?
Well, I think Russia's diplomats, and I think a lot of Russian leaders, understand it really well. The problem, the mistake we keep making, is that we think that matters to Putin. We assume, especially people that have gotten very defensive about President Obama's policies, they say, well, you know, we're really hurting Russia and we're really hurting the Russian economy. But that whole notion is based on the assumption that Putin cares about how much he's hurting the Russian economy. That's mirror imaging him to assume that he cares as much about the material well-being of the people in the street in his country as we care about ours. And the fact of the matter is he doesn't. And this goes back to your point about the BRICS, because one of the reasons I think we were so fascinated by the whole notion of the BRICS arising as a bloc is because the study of international affairs in the United States is heavily dominated by realists. And realists tend to look at the map as like a big game of Risk, where all the pieces are just different colors, but that everybody's going to balance and they're going to think in terms of interest and they're going to create these very natural kind of alignments. And the reason the BRICS made sense, we thought it made sense for the Russians, is because it made sense to us, because that's what we would have done. Right after the fall of the Soviet Union, the articles already began coming out of, you know, the academic study of international relations, where people said, well, now Russia and China will balance the United States. They're going to be balancers. So they're going to be coalitions that come together to balance the only, as you say, you know, just as Brazil disappointed the futurists, these predictions kept getting pushed, you know, 10 years further. Well, it didn't happen this year. It'll happen next year. And it doesn't happen, because that leaves aside some very important things, like the fact that the Chinese and the Indians hate each other, and that the Russians and the Indians, the Russians and the Chinese on an almost molecular level don't trust each other. I never thought that the BRICS, I'm not an economist, but I'm a political scientist and I'm a Russia guy. To me, the idea of the BRICS being a coherent thing never made sense, because it involves four groups of people that just are not going to cooperate with each other. The same goes for an organization we're not talking about, but falls into the same category, which is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. that was supposed to be the next big thing, where Russia was going to gather all the little former Soviet chicklets, chicks under its wings like a big mother hen, and then it was going to get together with China, and all the stands would be brought into it, and there'd be this kind of Russia-China-Eurasia counterbalance to the West. Of course, the SCO couldn't get off the ground, because you're not going to get those groups of people to agree with each other. They have very different interests. They have very different cultures. They have very different outlooks on things. They have very different kinds of regimes. And so I think we're still in a world where, you know, the Russians are pretty much having to go it alone. And the only thing that we really, I shouldn't say the only thing, but an important thing that we need to keep our eye on is that's less important to Putin than we think it is. Having alliances and healthy diplomatic and economic ties in all directions is something that's very important to Western countries. It's not necessarily important to Putin because of the nature, again, of that Putinist regime, that as long as it can survive, that's what it really cares about. Regime survival is number one. Great power status is number two. Getting even for the end of the Cold War is number three, four, and five. In a series of priorities that really don't make a lot of sense to us as Westerners, but do make a lot of sense to a guy that, you know, was born in the 1950s and came out of the KGB.
Well, you talk about regime survival. Let's pull on that one a little bit, because in this kleptocracy or oligarchy or whatever he's got going there, in addition to the money he's looted, what are the threats to his survival as the head of Russia?
One thing I meant to add, though, about the inferiority complex, but I have to use this great line from Professor Lawrence Friedman at King's College in London, who said many times that dealing with Russia is like therapy. It's like being their therapist. Yes, you're important. Yes, you're a big country. Yes, we respect you. It's like dealing with a country that has this really serious need for affirmation and reassurance all the time. As far as what could constitute threats to the regime, it's a truism to say that if a snap election were held tomorrow, Putin would probably win it. I would argue that, in fact, Putin is popular because he now is at the point where he controls all the options that Russians would have chosen. I mean, he's popular because I think Russians can't really see any alternative to him. And he's squashed the emerging threat to him 4 or 5 years ago that was really coming out of a Russian middle class. And I would argue the Russian middle class is where the real danger to Putin lies, where a real danger to Putin lies. The poorest Russians are going to love Putin because they are, you know, there's a kind of an ignorant, reflexive support for him because he pushes a narrative that they feel very strong about, that they're poor and their lives suck because the Westerners and traitors in the Soviet Communist Party, like Gorbachev, really did this to them, and Putin's going to get even with everybody. I mean, you know, this is kind of Putin as Donald Trump in the new Russia, that, you know, everybody's corrupt and everybody's an idiot and everybody's stupid, and Putin's the strong man who's getting even, you know, on our part. The extremely wealthy in Russia have no interest, especially after what Putin did to Khodorkovsky, a wealthy Russian oligarch named Mikhail Khodorkovsky, clapped him in jail for 10 years. The super rich in Russia have no incentive to tangle with Putin. What they have an incentive to do is to quietly move their money out of the country, educate their children in Britain, and, you know, sort of stay as far away from politics as they can. It's the middle class that's caught in between those groups of people, the people that are smart enough to know that the old narrative isn't true, the people that have traveled just enough to know that the West isn't the way Putin and others have depicted it, the people who have increased their living standard but aren't rich enough to really make it without having to really work their asses off and to just scramble every day to get by in this hyper-competitive economy. They're the ones that I think, you know, they're the ones that certainly came into the streets in Moscow some years ago when Putin decided to go for a third term, and they're the ones that he really had to squash in a hurry. Those are the people that are doing things like, they're the people that are doing things Putin really objects to, like using the internet you know, going on Twitter, posting things on websites. One of the things Putin does not understand, I would argue, is the globalized nature of 21st century communications. And he fears it, and he fears the people who get it. And that's where he thinks there's a real threat. And that, I think he's right, because one of the things we've seen in this modern century, in the past 20 years of this new century, is that when a leader is unpopular, when opposition starts to gel to a particular leader, it can happen very quickly because it's enabled by communications and technology. And Putin decided that's not going to be me. What he fears more than anything is a color revolution, an orange revolution or a rose revolution or a purple or green or pink revolution or whatever it's going to be, that suddenly sprouts up out of the ground, out of nowhere, travels like wildfire through the internet, through communications technology, and suddenly mobilizes millions of people to make his regime untenable to the point where he has to use violence. Because part of his deal with the Russian people is no more violence. He promised them order. He promised them, you know, more a quieter life than the craziness that they were living through in the 1990s. And he has to deliver on that. And he's going to find those promises harder and harder to deliver on because, you know, like every gangster, he can't control everything that's going on around him. And I think that's going to get out of control at some point. I still have a question about whether he really ordered the hit on Boris Nemtsov. He couldn't have happened without his approval, at least tacitly. It's only one of two possibilities. Either he approved the hit, which means he was really scared and he was really worried about it, or he put out a kind of vibe to his underlings that said it was okay to kill this guy, but probably didn't want it to happen. In that case, it means he's lost control. And neither one of those are good alternatives, because the one thing that didn't happen in the old Soviet Union, as awful as it was that opposition guys were not machine gunned down in the street, or pistol fired down in the street the way Nemtsov was. And I think that was a big line for him to cross. And it said either he's very scared or he's not in control. And either one of those are not a good option for the further stability of Russia.
Speaking of things that feed on Russian insecurity, let's touch on their near abroad. When you look at the former Soviet republics, you have a whole spectrum. You've got the Baltic states that are now part of Russia. Of course, you have the other members of the Warsaw Pact. NATO. I've been saying the R word too much. You have the other former members of the Warsaw Pact that have joined up with the other team. And then you have the other spectrum of the former republics, where you go from Georgia, that would love to be part of NATO, but that's a bridge too far, to the client state, Belarus, as well. And when you look at what's happened with Ukraine, the other republic that really pops to the top of my head is Kazakhstan, and how that relationship, where is that Russian spectrum? And we know their interesting operations in Eastern Ukraine kind of speak for themselves. Where else in their near abroad is their greatest insecurity?
Well, it's important to divide out Ukraine in here and talk about that for a moment, because Kazakhstan is an artificial, well, first of all of the borders of the, you know, 21st century in places like the Soviet Union, the Middle East, Africa, they're all artificial to some extent. In the case of the Middle East, you know, these are post-colonial borders drawn by British and French cartographers. In the Soviet Union, those borders were drawn by Stalin. I mean, the countries that you see trying to make a go of it as independent entities now are trying to deal with borders that were created in a Stalin-driven constitution in 1936, and then with addenda and alterations over the years, like Khrushchev handing Crimea from Russia to Ukraine as a gift in the 1950s. So the borders of these countries are somewhat unnatural in a lot of places, and they were created to be. This is something that's really important for your listeners to understand, is that the Soviet authorities created these borders specifically to prevent what actually happened, which is the Soviet Union coming apart. They created these borders with artificial divisions running through areas that would divide up ethnic groups and move resources from one side of a border to another, because they were trying to create a big jigsaw puzzle that could never come unlocked. So now that it has, there are all these problems spread out throughout the former Soviet space. But that said, it's also important to remember that Russia, as a culture, has a very strong ethnic Russian racism in it, that people in the Stans, people in the Muslim world, they're really not viewed by on the same level, certainly not by people like Putin or a lot of other people from the Soviet era, as equivalent to the ethnic Russians. And Kazakhstan is a unique case, because a lot of Russians, ethnic Russians, were intentionally resettled into Kazakhstan to try to Sovietize it, to make it less Muslim, less Central Asian, less, more Russian-speaking, more ethnically Russian, because that was the part of the path toward making it more Soviet in general. Ukraine, however, occupies a very special place in the Russian imagination, because the Russians really view Ukraine as the kind of the place where their culture was born. It's the home, it's where their religion was centered. It's a part of a Slavic core along with Belarus that Russia cannot imagine, at least a lot of Russians, I shouldn't say Russia, I shouldn't speak for the whole country that way, but a lot of Russians, Putin clearly included, they cannot imagine it as an independent entity away from Russia. They see that as a part of greater Slavic core, the same way the Serbians could not imagine Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo, places around them as anything but part of a greater Serbia. And that creates a lot of problems. Now, there's an irony in all this. Putin attacks Ukraine on the premise that he can't allow a nationalistic anti-Russian Ukraine to be formed. In doing so, he has created a nationalistic anti-Russian Ukraine. He has brought about the thing he fears the most in Ukraine, and I would say that's still at the top of his agenda. Kazakhstan's run by a former Soviet bureaucrat. They're going to get along fine. You know, they understand each other. The Stans, again, are run by people that aren't really interested in tangling with Russia. They'll make the deals they need to make. Ukraine is the unique case, because what Putin's done by seizing Crimea and shearing off that eastern edge of Ukraine is that he sheared off the people that would have been a moderating influence on a more nationalistic Ukrainian regime. In other words, he took away the ethnic group that is the Russians, who would have forced Ukrainians to be more moderate, to compromise in a government in Kiev. It's kind of like, you know, redistricting in America, where you take all the people of one party and you cluster them all into one district. And that means that the district right next to it becomes more extreme as well. I mean, that's what happened in American congressional districts. You crowded all the Democrats into one district, you crowded all the Republicans into another. And as a result, the politics in both districts become more extreme. That's what's happening in Russia and Ukraine right now, is the Russians are peeling off all of the separatist Russians who would have normally been people the Ukrainian regime would have to deal with. The only people that are going to be left in the new Ukraine in a year or two, I would say even now, are people who hate the Russians, because anybody who likes Russia is already there. And that's just stupid. And I'll just add one more comment about this before I stop, which is, we have a tendency to think that all world leaders are good strategists. Putin's activities in Ukraine prove that he really sucks at strategy. This was the dumbest possible thing he could have done. It was emotional. It was ad hoc. It was a seat of the pants call that was driven heavily by his humiliation when the Ukrainians drove out his preferred guy. And he's now created a situation that's actually worse than the one he would have had a year or two ago. If the Ukrainians had formed a closer association with the European Union, that would have just put more money flowing into a Ukrainian regime led by a crony of Putin himself, which would have meant more money flowing to Russia. And, you know, this idea that Ukraine was going to join NATO in the next few years was just nonsense. That's just Russian. I mean, of course, you know, NATO said, well, of course, anybody who wants to join us, we have to think about it, and we're very flattered. And, but there was no movement toward that. Putin's now created a situation where instead of getting more money and a Ukrainian regime led by one of his guys that would have been fatter, dumber, and happier with European money flowing into it, he's put himself under sanctions. He sheared off the people that would have moderated a Ukrainian regime that was left intact. And he's created a hyper-nationalist Ukraine that now has a national identity that didn't exist before and sees itself primarily in terms of opposing Russia. Bad strategy all around, but, you know, nobody ever said gangsters are good strategists.
Yeah, I think I've seen a number of articles recently about his poor strategic actions, otherwise known as blunders, which included Ukraine. And I'm also thinking along those lines that the revised or energized interest in NATO by the smaller Baltic countries would be part of that too. Is that on the right track?
Absolutely. You know, in the early 1990s, I actually wrote about not expanding NATO beyond Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary. I said at the time, you know, because of the terrible things that happened in 1956, 1980, and 1968, at the very least, those three countries had to be brought into NATO, partly for both Russia and the United States and the West to kind of atone for what happened. I said at that point, just stop. And in fact, I was in Russia in the early 90s. I was talking to Russian legislators who were actually pro-Western legislators, but they were saying things like, why are you doing this? You know, why are you making this so hard on us? You're talking about, you know, bringing the Baltics into Russia. You're going to empower the hyper-nationalists. You're really making things difficult for us. And I said, look, I don't work for President Clinton. It's not my call about expanding NATO. The problem now is that the Russians have played right down to the very worst stereotypes and fulfilled the notion of threat that the Balts were warning us would happen. And again, you know, I've had to backtrack now and say, well, I never thought the Russians would react this way. I think it's unfortunate that American realists, you know, people like John Mearsheimer and others, Steve Cohen, have been basically flacking for the regime and saying, well, you know, it's our own fault and we made them feel insecure. There's nobody to blame here but the Putin regime, because if anything, rather than provoking them into threatening these countries, the deepest fears of the Balts have actually been shown to be true, that the Russians really are bent on recreating the Soviet space and dominating all those countries right out through the former Warsaw Pact. And I think that's, again, kind of an emanation of Putin specifically. I don't think had Yeltsin stayed in power or someone like Yeltsin had come to power, I think that there were people in the Russian regime who were Atlanticists, who felt like that, you know, NATO expansion was not that direct a threat to them. But I can't deny that the leadership of the Baltic states and the Poles, who were more alarmist than they should be, have been proven right. I still think I wouldn't have supported the way we did NATO expansion. We did it too quickly. We did it kind of, I would argue the Clinton regime did it while the Clinton administration did it while sticking a finger in the eye of the Yeltsin regime, with whom we otherwise had pretty good relations. You know, we had a lot of talk from people like Madeleine Albright about being indispensable, and if the Russians don't like it, that's tough. So, you know, we certainly bear some blame for doing this in a kind of clumsy, typically American, ham-fisted way. None of that excuses what the Russians have done since, and I think it's shown that the Balts were absolutely right to seek NATO membership, and that the Poles were absolutely right that the Russians are a continuing threat to the stability of Central Europe. And I'll just add, I say that with sadness, because I really thought there was a chance here for Europe to finally get some peace and quiet, and that the Russians wanted that as much as anybody else. And I think that's still true. I think there are a lot of Russians who would prefer things to be that way, but Putin's not leaving that open as an option for them.
Yeah, I share your disappointment there, because it really was an opportunity to go in a different direction, and you almost just want to shake your head and go, really? really, but you know, that's what history does to us. And something else that I think the instinct is to just look the other way and prefer not to even think about it. But something else Russia has done recently to bring back a specter that we thought we had left behind. They've in the last, really over this summer and in late spring, they're going to bring back production of the Tu-160. Some people, I don't know if you might be able to give us some insight whether this is a hard break or a soft break of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. They tested the MIRVed version of the SS-27. They've tested the R-500 cruise missile. Basically, they're bringing the nuclear genie back out and polishing off the side. How much of this is just thumping their chest to get that Soviet nostalgia back again, or how much of this really ratchets up the nuclear threshold potential that the West needs to take a deep breath and really look at what its policies and what it needs to do to respond?
Well, we don't have to pick among those because it's all of them. The Russians are ratcheting up a nuclear threat, and their talk about Putin's talk, especially about nuclear use, is reckless and I think, you know, slightly unhinged. I also think, however, that some of it is just a hug the Russians are giving themselves, that it is part of their great power status, because what they really don't want to admit, and you know, nobody really is comfortable saying out loud, is, you know, their conventional forces aren't that good. They may have local superiority at any given time, any place they want to try and do that in Europe, but in a way we've switched roles with them. There's no way in which the Russians can seriously sustain some kind of conventional campaign in Europe. I mean, they don't have the air power, they don't have the same level of training and professionalism and logistics, all the stuff that, you know, the old Soviet Union would have had going into a fight against NATO. They simply don't have that. So of course they lean on their nuclear crutch. I would also add that I see this as epic level trolling of the West by the Putin regime to see if it can bait us into a Cold War relationship. And you may wonder why they would do that, because if we're in that Cold War deterrence relationship with them, if we say things like, well, you know, us and the Soviet Union, the heirs of the Soviet Union, and we're back in that, you know, scorpions in a bottle relationship, and we're constraining each other with mutual assured destruction, that gives Putin and his guys what they want more than anything, which is a peer relationship with the United States. The thing they hate is when the United States says things like, so, as Condi Rice did this when they flew a bomber to Venezuela, they flew a strategic bomber to Venezuela as a kind of a stunt. And, you know, Kerry and Rice and Condi Rice and Republicans and Democrats both went, so what? Big deal. So they flew a bomber to Venezuela. You know, we do that every day. We could do that at will. And they thought it was a big deal. They hate that because they know it's true. And that's why they're constantly poking us around the fringes of Canada, northern our northern air defense zones, coming close to California, because they're trying to pump their chest and say, look, we can do it too. We're big kids again. And they would love for us to go back to that relationship. That's partly why they're doing all of this. The INF treaty violation is, you know, you asked, is a hard break or a soft break? I guess if you talk to the administration, which I think it's good to say I don't represent here and I don't represent the government, you'll probably hear from them, well, yeah, technically it's a violation, but it's not a big deal yet. They haven't deployed anything. Well, all of which is true. But there's a political content to what they've done, which is to say, look, we're willing to wipe our feet all over the INF treaty. You know, we're willing to break that treaty just to show you we can. Almost like, again, as a kind of defiant act of wannabe superpowerism. But there's another piece of this that you always have to bear in mind, which is that Putin and the Russian leadership are saddled with a huge nuclear establishment of guys, scientists and officers and factories, and those guys got to get paid. You've got to keep that budget rolling. So of course they're going to replace the SS-18 at the end of its service life. Of course, they're going to work on big nuclear projects because they have to spend that money there. I wrote a piece in the National Interest where I said, so if they create 10 more blackjacks, you know, if they field 10 more T-160s, who cares? You know, what? That's not going to win World War III, and it's not going to affect the strategic balance of power. But you could see them doing it as a way of trying to make the Europeans nervous and to get the Americans to pay attention to them. That's part of that therapy that Professor Friedman talks about saying, well, you're very powerful. We're paying attention to you. You're a great power. We see you. We see what you're doing. And I think we should refuse to let ourselves be trolled by that. I don't think the future of our relationship with Russia is based in a nuclear competition. I think what we ought to be doing is leaving that aside and bolstering the conventional capabilities of NATO to prevent any kind of Russian adventurism on our borders in NATO. We have the conventional advantage now. It used to be the other way around. We had to rely on nuclear weapons because we were totally outnumbered and outgunned by a hostile empire that spanned the globe that was constantly threatening to attack us in Europe. We now need a peaceful alliance of countries that are conventionally superior to a rump Russian, you know, rump Soviet state in Russia. And I just don't think we ought to be responding to these threats symmetrically by saying, well, they've built more nuclear weapons, we have to build more nuclear weapons. They're violating the INF Treaty, we should trash the INF Treaty. I think there are cold warriors in the United States who would love to see that. They would love to get into that comfort zone of the relationship they once knew with the Soviet Union back in the 70s and the 80s. But I think that's stupid. I think that that's exactly what Putin wants us to do, because it moves the competition into a place that he's comfortable with as well. And it's always a bad rule of strategy to play on the turf that your adversary prefers and where your adversary is comfortable.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because recently some of our military leaders have been pointing to Russia as our number one threat. Now, is this a recognition that because, just as you described, NATO once was under would be overwhelmed easily by the Soviet conventional forces, is Russia in the position now where their first resort can't be their conventional forces? They would almost have to go nuclear. And is that, and since we don't know where Putin's mind is all the time anyway, is that why they're back to being number one with a bullet?
No, actually, and I think that General Odierno and others were right to point out Russia as our potentially most dangerous, existentially threatening adversary, not because the Russians can do it, but ironically, because and I say ironically because the Russians can't do it. I think the fear everybody has, and I'm you know, speaking only for myself, but I think a fear that I've heard expressed enough times that I think it's pretty widely shared among a lot of American and European analysts of this problem, is not that Russia is going to somehow, you know, blitzkrieg its way to Tallinn and take over the Baltics and, you know, invade Poland and start World War III. It's that they're going to keep trying to replicate the Crimean operation, that they're going to foment some kind of a problem among Russian speakers in a country on their border, in the Baltics or on the edge of Poland. They're going to put in the little green men without uniforms or without insignia. They're going to claim to be supporting the rights of ethnic Russians. They're going to start sending help. There's going to be some kind of dramatic incident where they're going to press a military solution, and then NATO gets dragged into a war by little degrees, where the Russians thought they were kind of boiling the frog, to use that old metaphor. They're going to blunder into something where NATO's going to have to respond. There's going to be an Article 5 reaction that the Russians, I think, are increasingly thinking won't happen. And then they find themselves in a confrontation with the West that even they didn't want. And the next thing you know, we're at each other's throats with potentially the use of nuclear weapons. And that's my biggest fear. It's not that the Russians are confident and tough and conventionally able. It's that the Russians are stupid and blundering, and that they are underestimating us. Because I think that is how wars get started. I think they also have a specific view that this Russian regime in Moscow has a very specific view of the Obama administration as feckless, as loath to engage, as uninterested in European affairs. And, you know, to some extent, they have a point that the Obama administration has not been particularly interested in European affairs. When you talk about a pivot to Asia, you're sending a message to everybody who's not Asia. And I think the Russians have taken advantage of that, but I also think they're underestimating and misunderstanding the degree to which NATO is not just one man in any given moment. NATO is 28 countries. There's a lot of people and a lot of other human beings involved in an Article 5 situation. And I think they're engaging in behavior that's really reckless. And I can understand why military leaders are concerned that NATO is now again the kind of Central Europe is now the most dangerous place. And the Chinese are difficult and reckless, and I think doing things that are astonishing, like creating islands out of whole cloth in the middle of nowhere. But in some sense, I think the Chinese, and I'm not a China expert, so I'll put this out there as purely an impression, that the Chinese feel like they have a lot to lose. They play their cards pretty carefully. They try things and they go with what works and what doesn't. I think what we're all afraid of is that Putin is like a gambler on a hot streak who just doesn't know when to quit doubling down. Everybody who's ever been in a casino has seen the guy next to you where you start mumbling under your breath, dude, walk away, take your money and cash out. And I think Putin is the guy who just doesn't know when to cash out. And that really worries me. And I would totally understand if that's what really worries UCOM and NATO commanders and European commands as well. I mean, it just makes sense to me.
I would feel remiss if I didn't try to tie in here the latest news on the nuclear front and how Russia views it. In some ways, I think that there is a trend in Putin's Russia that if something can happen that in the short term upsets Americans and creates conflict in America, then that's a good thing, regardless of what might happen in the long term for Russia. And specifically, the potential down the road for a nuclear Iran and Iranian support for terror in the long run, one would think that there would be perhaps not as much cooperation as one would think. You have Chechnya, you have the problems in the Caucasus as well. With nuclear proliferation in nations such as Iran, whether it's 1 year, 10 years, 15 years from now, is there much thought or concern in Russia on their southern periphery and any potential blowback there may come to have yet more nuclear armed nations on their borders, Western or not?
I don't think the Russians are that worried about blowback, but I agree that Russian strategic thinking tends to be heavily short-term and aimed at, we talked about this earlier, kind of annoying the United States at any moment. With that said, however, of course, right at the tail end of this, opening that Pandora's box of the Iran deal is always a dangerous thing to do. But I actually think of the Iran deal as a very clever trap that was set by the Russians and the Iranians, and we walked right into it because it's what we wanted. We were so eager to get this deal that the Russians and the Iranians have gladly sucked us into it and cooperated with each other in making this as disastrously difficult as possible. I'll even go a step further and say what I think the Russians really want out of the Iran deal is for the Congress to tank the whole deal so that all the sanctions fall apart. They can deal with Iran at will. They can leave us behind, and Iran can do what it wants, and nobody even has to go through the pretense of enforcing sanctions. But I don't think that the Russians have any intention of cooperating with us on enforcing any kind of JCPOA agreement stuff. This was something they did to humor us because we wanted it. They're taking a long view, which is that eventually Iran's going to do what Iran wants to do. The Russians will do what they want to do. And the Americans, having checked that box and signed off, are going to go back to ignoring the whole business, because that's, Americans are like that. We don't like staying engaged with these issues. And the Russians and the Iranians know it, and they're counting on it. So in this, I would actually say the Russians and the Iranians have been longer term thinkers than we have. We're the ones that have gone into this ad hoc kind of, must get a deal mentality, and the Russians, I think, are the ones who've thought this out long term. With that said, I don't think the Russians are losing a whole lot of sleep about an Iranian bomb on their borders. I think they worried a lot more about proliferation and loose nukes in the 90s, when the loyalties of a lot of the post-Soviet militaries in those regions were unclear. Nobody knew who was reporting to whom. I remember talking to Russian generals in the early 1990s and seeing them give talks where they said, you know, they looked physically alarmed at the possibility that somebody was going to set off either a bomb or a dirty bomb or some kind of device in old Moscow after the fall of the Soviet Union, because nobody knew what was going on. 20 years later, all those former, you know, they know the nuclear weapons have either been accounted for or they don't work. I mean, that's 20 years, a long time in the life of a nuclear weapon. And I think they worry about that a lot less now. Now I think they're looking at it as anything they can do with the Iran deal that makes the Americans miserable is probably a good thing. And I think, again, they're baiting us. They're almost trolling us to see if we'll turn down the deal so that they can get the best of all worlds, which is to get rid of the sanctions now instead of having to let them dribble away over time with better Iranian behavior.
So much for the world. Go ahead, Eagle One.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thank Tom for his hour and his time and ask him, I mean, it's been a very fast hour and quite interesting. What are we going to see from you in print or otherwise in the near future?
Well, thanks for asking. You'll see the occasional piece, probably as the Iran deal matures, and of course I write on Russian element. The next book in the works is a piece that I wrote that went viral a few years ago called The Death of Expertise, which is basically a book about why experts and laymen don't get along with each other anymore and why laymen don't listen to professional experts and take their advice anymore, whether it's in foreign policy or vaccinations or anything else. And I wrote about that a few years back. It went kind of exploded. And so now I'm working on a book for Oxford University Press.
Well, I look forward to that, Tom. And I do really appreciate you taking time this Sunday to spend an hour with us. And we look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you both for having me. And it was great chatting with you.
It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.